Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth, a place where you can drop your questions about practical spirituality, and I will be coming up with answers for them with prayers to Swami, of course. So let me begin by offering my most loving salutations at Swami's lotus feet. We just concluded the Guru Purnima celebrations, and in fact, the celebrations are still on. For this evening, we have a presentation by the devotees from the North European countries. They formed the group and called themselves the Sarvadharma Choir, and they've been performing for quite some time, of quite a few years in front of Swami now. Speaking of Swami as Guru, one fascinating analogy that Swami would give always comes to my mind. Let's say you walk into a dark room. You then bang into all the furniture and objects that are strewn all over the place. Because it's dark and you don't know how to get from one end of the room to the other. Then you call out for help. The person who comes to your aid does not clear your path. Instead, he does not even move out the furniture so that you can move from one end of the room to the other without banging into any of them. But he does something which is different. He just turns on the lights. Things are where they are, but now you can see them better and maneuver around. Swami says that is what a guru does. He does not remove obstacles and problems from your life. He just illumines your path and then, boom, you can find your way without banging into them and hurting yourself. But how fortunate are we, for the guru who illumines our path is the very source of all light and wisdom itself. Let us offer our immense gratitude to our most beloved guide, guru, guardian and God, our dearest Swami. Time now to head to the quote of the week, and of course to the question after that. Well, today's quote is from someone who probably is the youngest person whose quote I've read on this program. The quote is from a young poet and lyricist by name Chris Jammy, and these are from his book called Venus in Arms. I quote, "When a poet digs himself into a hole, he doesn't climb out. He digs deeper, enjoys the scenery, and comes out the other side enlightened." End of quote. Though the word used here is poet, I want to extend the context a little bit more. After all, if you read Sanskrit literature, we would often come across this word called kavi, right? Kavi is the word for poet in Sanskrit. And kavi is actually used for more than just a poet. Kavi is used to refer to a person of wisdom. Well, I'm sure Chris Jammy wasn't thinking of kavi as used in Sanskrit when he wrote that poem, but even otherwise, a poet is someone who looks deeper than what meets the eye, one who looks for beauty in pain, for rhythm in chaos. To be fair to life, however partial life may seem to be, life is absolutely undiscriminating. It puts all of us through darkness and anxiety at some time or the other. But if we can be like a poet who is looking to create something beautiful even out of pain, then we will not merely attempt to struggle out of that hole we are thrown into, but we will explore the hole, enjoy it, and come out enlightened. Didn't the whole epic of Ramayana start with a moment like that? Sage Valmiki is called Adi Kavi, or the first poet, because it is believed that there was no poetry till that point in time. There were only chants and incantations. But when Sage Valmiki was pained when he saw a hunter killing the male bird in a pair, he was so pained and so moved by that pain that he burst out in poetry. That's how the epic poem Ramayana actually begins. The thing is, pain and suffering cannot make us wise. But if we develop the attitude of looking deep within ourselves and into situations outside during uncritical times, when we are put through critical times, dark and painful times, it will draw out the wisdom from within. So we all may end up in a deep hole by some silly things we do, but let us be sure that if we have been a good student in Swami's spiritual training, the tough situations can only make us wiser, can only take us closer to Swami. So before heading to the question, dear listeners, permit me to read that quote by Chris Jammy one more time for all of you. I quote, When a poet digs himself into a hole, he doesn't climb out. He digs deeper, enjoys the scenery, and comes out the other side enlightened. to the question of this week. The person who sent me the question wishes to be anonymous, so that's how he will remain. But he's been very kind to send us a recording of the question. So I'll play out the question for you. It's a very important question. The question is, of course, specific to the problem that this person and his family is facing. But the question gives me an opportunity to speak about something very important. So let's first listen to the question. We'll reserve for the answer after that.
Dear Brother Prem, Sai Ram, this incarnated soul, who will be referred to as I, is ever grateful to Swami for bestowing His grace to be able to listen to Radio Sai and Answering Booth. I sincerely thank you and the team for orchestrating such a program. Me and my wife currently live in Vancouver, Canada. I am working as a data analyst. My work is about an hour's drive, and I have been getting the wonderful chance to tune into Radio Sai on the way and from work most of the days. To give you an insight, my family has been a Sai devotee since the last 34 years. Parents are both doctors in India. Mom also participates regularly in Seva clinics. Dad also does charitable work through free operations, free medicines, and donation of intraocular lenses to his patients who cannot afford cataract surgery. I consider to be very lucky to be born in this family. My parents were quite liberal about most of the aspects. I have a sister who is living with my parents in India. She is 9 years younger to me. She was doing well until her class 10. She was extremely sensitive, well-mannered, and shy person. She was the one who could be hurt easily. After graduating into intermediate, things changed. Her mannerism, dressing sense, and talk started inclining away from the norms of the society. She started becoming increasingly rebellious. Due to this, she and my parents had many altercations. She somehow did not seem to like the norms of this double standard society. She completed her intermediate and joined engineering. Due to reasons unknown, she discontinued her studies. She does not like any rules, especially if they are cultural or the ones belonging to society. She has been suffering from depression since several years. She refuses any psychological or psychiatric help. She has become very unstable-minded. Of late, she has been saying that her days are numbered and she is going to die soon. She often breaks down and weeps. She feels worthless. She talks about death and suicide every day. She stays up all night and sleeps during the day. Our family is in a turmoil. We are allowing her to live as she likes and supporting her in every way possible. What can we do to tackle this situation? How to motivate an individual to live a meaningful life? What should be one's motivation to live in this world? What can we do to help her? Sai Ram.
Thank you, brother, for that question. I sincerely pray to Swami that he helps you out with this situation that your sister is in. You did mention that she is averse to medical treatment. But my first and foremost, my advice would be that she certainly needs professional help. There's no doubt about that. I mean, if somebody is in this kind of a traumatic state for an extended period of time, she certainly needs professional medical help. And I think that is the first thing that you need to do more than anything else. I will try to explain why that is important. I'm not an expert in this field of neuroscience, but with whatever little understanding I have, I'll try to explain that it's a classic case of she needing some external intervention for helping her do better. Because everything else that I can tell you from what we've learned from Swami can come in only after that. I'll come to that part. But specific to what you mentioned about, you know, she becoming rebellious and saying that she's not able to put up with this double standard world, there must have been some series of incidents which has really triggered this kind of rebellious attitude in her. That again, it's very difficult to say without really knowing what's happened. And someone's got to really sit down and talk to her and get the thing out and help her understand things and put things in perspective. So it's very difficult to tell without knowing some details about what specifically has happened. But going back to that, my first advice, she needs medical help. I'll explain. But of course, you also said, what is it? How do you really motivate a person who is probably in this kind of a situation? Putting both together, the reason why I'm saying that she needs medical help and is that most families which are in a stable state, right? Like the family that you've described, it's a beautiful family where the parents are well educated, the parents are responsible citizens, they're involved in seva, you have a devotional atmosphere already in your family. Any family which is in such a state actually has enough buffer to handle these kind of normal traumatic experiences that an individual would go through. You know, we all go through ups and downs in life. We all go through moments where we are depressed. But a family such as this, such as what you've described your family to be, has enough buffer to handle normal ups and downs in life. So in spite of that, if she's in a situation like this and she's been in this situation for an extended period of time, all of what you described is a classic example of clinical depression. She certainly needs professional help. She needs some medication. I'll explain that part in some time to come. But talking about this in general, you know, what really keeps us happy, what really keeps us cheerful, the philosophical part apart, the spiritual part apart, I'll probably talk a little about the science behind why, what keeps us cheerful, what keeps us happy, what keeps us hopeful. Because we will see that, you know, many of the things that we are taught to do in life, especially by Swami, I mean, even as I go through these, you know, scientific explanations of what keeps us happy and going, it only fills us with so much gratitude, because without telling us that this is what Swami is doing for us, he put us in a routine which, you know, takes care of all of these things which is required for a normal, cheerful mindset. And after that, it's up to us, you know, how much we progress spiritually, how much we take our life forward. But the basic requirements for a cheerful, happy and positive life can be managed if we purely just follow what Swami expects us to do. But so to explain that, I'll try to go a little bit into the science or the neuroscience about, you know, what really happens in the brain and why probably at the end of that you will understand why it's important. I'm saying that she needs medication more than anything else before she starts any other form of she finds out anything else to pull up her mood, right? The human brain is a very, very phenomenal organ. You don't need me to say that. You all know that, and your parents will know that very well, being doctors. It's understood very little. Even today, with all the advancements in science, we've understood the human brain very little. But every little bit more we understand about the human brain, it is redefining what we have so far thought about as psychology. It is redefining the way we are studying social behavior. It's redefining the way we see crime. Because there's so much to be known in the brain which we have no clue about. But every little we know is giving us so much insight into what we have probably unconsciously followed, what we have observed in human behavior and we have followed, right? The basic function of the human brain, it's very simple. It is given the function of self-preservation, right? There is this complex mechanism, machine called the human brain. It's given only one duty. The duty of that human brain is to take care of the body in which it is housed, right? That's all is the basic function of the human brain. In fact, it's the basic function of any brain, even the mammals, even the other lower organisms, all of that which have a brain, which have a complex brain, the role of that brain is only this, self-preservation, right? And the problem or the issue when it comes to the human beings, right, is that the idea of the self is much more complex than in the animals, right? If you look at the animals, the only thing is the body, is probably the physical attributes of the animal. So when the animal brain thinks of self-preservation, it's all about preserving the physical body. So all of its mechanisms are geared towards preserving the body, whether it is in a situation where it is being chased by predators, or it's in situations where it's living in tough conditions. All the while the mind is trying to ensure how to preserve this body of the animal. Now when you come to humans, when you talk about the brain's function as being self-preservation, the idea of the self becomes very, very complex. It's extremely complex compared to even the mammals which just precede the human species, right? When you talk about self, you're talking about not only the body, you're talking about the emotional self, you're talking about respect that the self gets, you're talking about love that one gets, you're talking about the love that one can give. Friends, families, the social patterns, and all of this comes, and this idea of self becomes very complex, so the mechanism of the human brain also is very, very complex in trying to protect the self. And that is why that's the only thing which probably explains somebody who is ready to even kill themselves, right? Because if the brain is supposed to do self-preservation of the body, then how do you explain someone who is ready to kill themselves, either when they are going through a very tough period, or even in the name of religion, which we're seeing so much. Because this idea of self is much larger than the human body. And when the brain thinks that it can serve this idea of the self by even letting go of this body, it will go and do that, right? So this self-preservation mechanism of the brain in the case of humans becomes very complex because of this complex nature of the self in the human experience. But the mechanism is pretty similar in all of the brains, be it in the mammalian brain or even in the lower forms of organisms. That is just like how we probably train a dog. How do we train a dog? If we want it to do something, when the dog does it, we reward the dog. Or if it does something which it is not supposed to, we threaten the dog, probably with a stick, or we either physically beat it or we threaten to beat it, right? That's how we train a dog. It's almost in the same way the brain functions. That is, there are some actions that we do which is meant to take care of this body, which is benefiting this body. So when we do those actions, the brain will make you feel happy, right? It releases what we call neurotransmitters or hormones, or effectively called the happy hormones, you know, simplest way to put them. There are about 4 to 5 of them, which are called happy hormones. And this is how the brain works. When you do something that you're supposed to do, and when I say supposed to do, which benefits your idea of the self, then this brain starts releasing these neurotransmitters, which then makes you feel happy, makes you feel positive, right? This is a way by which the brain makes you repeat those actions which are good. And the simplest things are eating, sleeping, drinking water, probably doing some exercise. And all of these things which are meant to preserve the body have connected to them this response of happy hormones being secreted in the brain, right? But as I said, in the human experience, it becomes more complex. If you study the human brain as evolution, this reward system, which is central to the human brain, it's right in the middle of the system. It's supposed to be the oldest part of the brain biologically, which means even lizards have this thing. It's even called the amphibian brain at times, because it's the oldest part of the brain when you talk of it as evolution, right? But in the human brains, our most advanced is what we call the prefrontal cortex, which is right above our forehead. That part of the brain, this is where our idea of morality, social justice, of how we carry ourselves in the presence of others, all of these ideas, which is very, very advanced compared to any other beings, is housed in this part of the brain. So this now redefines this whole, the reward cycle, what is called the reward cycle. I do something, I feel happy about it in the brain because of the release of these happy hormones. And then there is a trigger of in the memory, asking the memory to remember the act and repeat it again because it makes you feel happy, right? So this is what happens in all brains, but in the human brain, because of we being larger than the physical body, we also have these emotional needs, right? So when we do something which is giving pleasure to the body, and when we do something which gives us emotional pleasure, then we comfort somebody, when we are comforted by somebody, when we are loved by somebody, when we are able to go and help somebody. All of these things have a similar response in the human brain, where you have these different types of happy hormones. I'll probably mention a few of them. And each of these have different roles to play. The simplest of them is supposed to be dopamine, which makes you feel happy. Then there is one called oxytocin, which is supposed to be triggered off when you do something which is about showing care to another person, hugging another person. It's also called the cuddle hormone. When somebody shows care and loving to you, this hormone is released. It's also something which makes you feel happy, right? These are happy hormones which have different ways in which they can be triggered. At the same time, they have different roles to play also. Then there is, of course, the third one, which is very, very important, which is called serotonin. I'll be talking mostly about that. This is a phenomenal hormone, which again is released when you're very positive, when you're very hopeful. And this is the hormone which actually makes you feel positive and hopeful too. When you have this hormone released in your brain, you might be facing something difficult. You might be going through a very difficult time in your life. But that which really tells your brain that don't worry, things will, you know, look up. Things will be fine, you'll get through this. That, literally like a counselor inside our own head, is this hormone called serotonin, right? And how does this hormone be released in the body? Very, very simple things that we already do. It is when we have good night's sleep, when we eat good, wholesome food, and when we exercise, not really very hard physical activity, but general activity which we do at home, and which we do normally in our regular life. All of these secrete the serotonin. That's why I said, you know, if you're in a good family environment, if you're going through, if you have caring parents around you, if you have siblings who care for you, you're living in a good neighborhood, you're eating good home food, well, wholesome food. You're not eating out of, preserved food, right? All of this will ensure that you have a good supply of the serotonin in your brain. And this will keep you hopeful. It's not that you will not go through depression, but you'll have a way of pulling yourself up. That's why we have always been told this traditionally, you know, don't think in an empty stomach. Eat something and think over your problem. Sleep over a problem. Because this is the chemical thing which actually happens in our brain. Because we can think more positively and more optimistically when these things happen, because the serotonin is released, right? And same way, physical activity. That's why in families, when you're doing a normal activity at home, be it cooking and gardening, housekeeping, or say something like carpentry, or taking care of your car, or any of these things, it actually is a means of keeping your brain topped up with this amazing neurotransmitter called serotonin, which keeps you positive and sharp, right? And that's the reason why children who are being brought up in good families, where there is both mother and father are taking good care of the children, cooking regularly for the children, and, you know, they offer this option of the children coming and opening up to them, that they have time to sit down and talk to the children about what's going on in their life. All of this will take care of the regular mental health of that person, and there will be no necessity to turn for any kind of medical help or psychological help, because the brain has enough in it to ensure that all of these things are there to keep you in balance, keep you positive, and keep you going, right? Similarly, when the serotonin is released, when, as I said, if you do all of these things, but the beauty is, even if there is another person who is giving you counsel, like you sit and you open up to your father or your mother or your elder brother or somebody like that, and then they tell you, don't worry, things will be fine, you know, be confident, you're good, you know, you can go through this, you have the inner strength. Somebody who gives us confidence from outside also actually releases this serotonin. So serotonin makes you positive, and if somebody makes you feel positive, again it is released. So it's a two-way process. That is why in a family, when you're able to talk to somebody, or you have friends with whom you can talk about your problems, all of this is taken care of. So that is why I said, you know, probably you will have to look at your sister's life and see where it actually she had a problem, and where she could not get this kind of support, where, you know, over a long period of time that she was probably sinking into this depression without anybody really taking it seriously or noticing that she is going through this, right? Now the question is, what happens in the case of depression when somebody is getting depressed? You know, when a person goes through any kind of a traumatic event or say a low of a low state for an extended period of time, maybe for school children it might be bullying in school or something like that, or they've been doing repeatedly bad in education and the kind of pressure that they've been having, whatever it is, when there is an extended period of being low and depressed, if you have once in a while, as I said, it's taken care of, you don't have to worry. But if there's an extended period, a lot of times when somebody has had an injury and who is bedridden for a couple of months, you know, you see that is when depression really steps in. So when there's an extended period where you're going through this low, what happens is the body slowly stops producing enough serotonin, right? There is a standard amount of serotonin which needs to be produced in the body, but slowly this starts drying up. The body stops. Over a period of time, the brain is seeing that you're not doing enough activities to trigger off the release of the serotonin. So the brain slowly shuts down those things which will release the serotonin. So eventually you start becoming biologically depressed. That is, your brain stops producing the serotonin. Well, that's when it becomes really dangerous. That's when it becomes a problem, because till now it was an emotional depression, but now it starts becoming what we call clinical depression or biological depression, where your brain stops producing enough of this serotonin which will make you feel positive from inside. So that is why I said, now if somebody is in this state, somebody has become depressed and has come to this state, you know, you could do all of what I will tell you in the end of this, but it will not help you, because biologically that person is shut down to produce the serotonin. And that is why when you go to a medical practitioner, and they will put you probably on a very, very short term on drugs which will help your brain start producing the serotonin. Right? It's a very, very short course. I think not more than 2 or 3 weeks is what they say. After that, you can do all of these things which will make you positive. And in many cases, therapies fail because of this, because when you go to a therapist and they put you on medication, your chemical levels are brought up to the average level which is required for healthy living. But after that, these people end up going back to their own environments which has caused them this depression. So you've brought them up to the average, but you're sending them back to the place where it is going to dip again. So that's why even now the psychiatrists say that it's not enough if you give medication. You need to teach people ways of creating happiness in their life. You know, that's what is going to take you forward. But as I said, in your case, given the family background that you're talking about, given the nature of your parents and all of that, I think that should not be a problem. If you do this therapy, you're going to go back and she's going to be absolutely fine. There are enough things to take care of that after that. But this kicking off the serotonin and the other happy hormones release in the brain needs to be done. If not for that, all that you do will not have any impact on her, or the impact will be absolutely minimal. And especially if someone's already started talking about death and killing oneself, I think it's a very serious thing that you need to look into. You cannot now, you know, the option of going to a therapist or not is not in her hand, right? She's not going to agree to that anyway. It's a call that the family has to take, and I think it's time that that call is taken. Now, coming to the point of what do you do after, let's say that you've taken her to therapy, or let's say any of us who were given to this kind of a depressed state. See, again, this depression is again something which can be triggered by the circumstances. That happens to many people, but it could even be hereditary, because as I said, you know, the brain is different for each one of us. It's again genetics and all of that. Some people might be biologically having a brain which is given to lesser production of serotonin, right? It could be even that. And they might be living in conditions which is not triggered of that response. They're living in happy environment. And sometimes some people might react more adversely to a bad situation than some others. That could just be a clearly biological aspect of the brain, right? So any of us can get into this. So what do we do to ensure that we go back to going back to having a good level of these chemicals in our brain. Because I'm talking like a medical professional, please take my words with as much caution as you can, because I'm an amateur. This is just my very, very basic understanding that I'm sharing with you. You really need to understand this better. You should do a reading of your own, or you should go to an expert who's going to explain this completely. But this is just a very, very basic understanding of what happens in the brain as I understand it and just sharing it with you. So what do you do when you start feeling low, when you start becoming like this? And as I said, the 3-4 things by which, especially the serotonin, which is so important to remain positive and to feel that you can go through this difficult period that you're going through, it is produced by very, very simple things. It is produced by having a good night's sleep, having a limited but a standard amount of sleep, not oversleeping, not undersleeping. That's why students who are preparing for an exam, or people who are in business who give too much of their time to business and don't give enough time for themselves to sleep, this is a very, very dangerous thing. So a good night's sleep, a standard 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours, I don't know, whatever is suitable to you. I think Swami would say 6 or 7 is good enough. So if that much can be given to the human body, you automatically every morning you will find that there will be a little bit of positivity than when you went to sleep the last night. And the other thing is good, healthy food. I mean, there is no, it is not enough emphasizing the importance of food. Swami would always say that as is the food, so is the mind. But it is becoming more and more clear now, because they say that especially this hormone, this neurotransmitter, serotonin, is released in the gut when the culture of the gut is good because of the good food that you eat. And that's why it's so important not to eat stale food, not to eat preserved food, not to eat packaged food. Yeah, once in a while, of course, but on a regular basis. That is why it's so important, you know, now when we look at it, what a very, very, very important role our mothers play in our life. Because, yes, you know, we enjoy the food, it's tasty food, but it really keeps us sane. We don't realize that. We don't probably thank them enough. But that is what really keeps us sane, keeps us positive, and gives us the enough inspiration to overcome all our troubles. So that is a very, very important thing. And the second thing is, of course, physical activity, right? So what I would probably suggest to you, brother, especially for your sister's case, again, once after you go through, take her through the medication process, is give her some activity which will keep her busy. It's not very hard activity, not that kind of jogging or a very intense exercise, but something which keeps the hand active. That's what they say, because anything which keeps you occupied without stressing you out too much physically will lead to a better release of this particular neurotransmitter. So something like gardening is a very, very good idea to, you know, especially for your sister. And going out into the sun as much as possible. That's again a very, very important thing. If you notice, in many Western countries where you have an extended period where you don't have enough sunlight, you would see that people are becoming more and more depressed because of that. It's because of this, because there is so much direct correlation between sunlight and our mental health. Right? And that's why, of course, there's a chemical pathway, they say vitamin D is produced, and vitamin D helps in the secretion of these. But that's a different thing, but as much as possible to go out into the sun. And the other thing which probably I'll speak about is the hormone which I mentioned, which is called oxytocin, right? Oxytocin is also called the love hormone or the cuddle hormone, which is said that when you show love to somebody, or when you are shown love by somebody, this is triggered off. This again is something which will keep your mind happy, and it is not established what is the correlation between these various happy hormones, but it is believed that one can trigger off the other, one can, take the role of the other at some times. I'm not sure if it is all accurate medically, but they say many of these things. That's why even when you're not positive enough, even when you're not able to pull yourself up, if somebody is there who can show you that love and care, whom you can show love and care to, it triggers off all of these processes. That's why it's so important to have good friends, to have a good family and all of this. So especially for your sister in your condition, probably something like taking care of a dog could be a very, very good way of, increasing the mental happiness. We don't realize that. In fact, now they're talking about the dog therapy, right? The therapy of having a dog. It can be very, very curative. That's what they say, especially for people who have gone through depression. So that's something you can think of. But all of this, of course, after the medication. Going back to your family condition, I think none of this can help as much as probably going back to a routine of bhajans and namasmarana and seva. And this again is, I'll tell you medically why this happens. Again, it's the same thing. The amount of help that namasmarana and bhajans can do is probably not studied enough medically. I'll not go there. But this very fact that, you have somebody as Swami to turn to, you turn to somebody like Swami and you say, the act of having faith that Swami will take care of me. I know I'm not able to see through this problem. I know I'm not seeing the other side of how I'll solve this problem. But Swami is there and Swami will take care of me. This one thought of faith and surrender, chemically will take care of all that I spoke of. Because once you have this positive nature, it will start triggering off this release of serotonin and it'll become like an avalanche of positivity after that. Because that is how important faith and surrender is. That's why they say if you look at the way people live in some of the poorest parts of India, it is unbelievable how people are still in sound mental health. It's unbelievable. And it comes from this. Swami says that this dependence they have on God, this love they have for God and this surrender they have in God, the pujas they do, the worships they do, all of this actually we don't realize it keeps them in very, very good mental health and which keeps them very positive to face the troubles that they face. And that is why, that's a different debate which is going on that, when we are trying to make our country secular, we are actually pulling out a safety net from under the feet of some of these underprivileged people. And that's a different debate altogether. But, this idea of having love for God, this feeling that Swami is there for me, Swami will take care of me, we have no idea how much of these serotonin, which is the positivity neurotransmitter, will be released. The oxytocin, which will be released, because the feeling of warmth that we feel towards Swami, the feeling that I love Swami and Swami loves me. See, these are all things that we take it for granted, when we come to Swami. That is why it makes us so positive. All of us have enough strength and ability to wade through the problems that we face in life. But sometimes we really lack that belief. And that is why more than anything else, this particular thing of going out and doing bhajans, doing seva again is a very, very important thing. That is again something which cannot be emphasized enough. Because when you do seva, which again I will bring it to the point where you are talking about, how do you keep yourself motivated? How do you motivate a person? And I will connect that with seva. Going back to the functioning of the brain, one thing that we need to say is there is a big difference between what we call the mind and the brain, right? The brain is probably the mechanics of the mind. But the mind is much larger and much subtler than what the brain can explain to us. But what the brain can explain to us itself is so immense, right? But the mind is so much more complex. Something like, let's say that I'm undergoing the karma which I've done in my past life. So because of that, I'm having some health problem, right? The karma is a very subtle and complex phenomena which I cannot completely understand, but it results in my physical body as some kind of discomfiture or some kind of pain or disease. And that's how it expresses in the body. Same is the case with the mind. We go through different levels of training in different lifetimes. That expresses itself as how the mind behaves, and probably there is a physical mechanism for that, and that's what is the brain. That's why I said there are some people who can deal with problems better, some people who are very, very vulnerable. How does that come? Probably it's because of this. The mind has gone through different levels of training over different births. So this question which often comes to our mind is, if by eating, if by sleeping, if by taking care of my body, these neurotransmitters which make me happy, these happy hormones are released in my brain, then why can't I keep doing this all my life? Why can't I just eat well, sleep well, take care of my physical needs, take care of my pleasures, and then lead my life? Can I lead my life entirely like this? There's a beautiful mechanism which happens in the brain. Just to give you an understanding of how it happens, we all know that the brain is filled with nerve cells, right? And when we talk about these happy hormones being released, what actually happens is one nerve cell communicates with another nerve cell by releasing these neurotransmitters, right? So there is a releasing nerve cell and there is a receptor nerve cell. And this happiness that we feel, or positivity which we feel, is when these neurotransmitters are in this transit, right? There is something called nerves synapses. So the more these transmitters are remaining in the synapses, the more happy we feel, the more positive we feel, right? So what happens when we are doing a certain activity for an extended period of time? Let's say I love eating, right? I keep eating all my life, say 2-3 decades. I don't do anything but just filling, the only source of pleasure that I have is through my eating. Let me put it that way. Let me say I lead a life like that. What happens is, over a period of time, the brain says, now this activity is being done, and this much neurotransmitters are released. So eventually, the brain starts adapting to this situation by producing more receptors, which means it will suck out all these neurotransmitters from the synapses, and eventually, the same activity will not give you as much joy as before. This is an inbuilt process in the brain. Over a period of time, the same amount of neurotransmitters will continue to be released with the action which you do, but they will be sucked out of these synapses and will give you lesser and lesser joy, lesser and lesser happiness as you go through it. This is the way by which the brain literally plateaus our pleasures. It doesn't allow us to have infinite pleasure from these finite pleasurable activities and things that we have around our life. And that's the beauty of nature itself. Swami would often say, the senses, Swami would say, has got a name in Sanskrit called matraha, which means it has a means of limiting. It is a measuring instrument, which means it limits how much you can take. And Swami would say that this senses, when you say eye, when you say mouth, it's not just the organ, but it is the organ in association with the mind, right? So this is the biological way by which it happens. It plateaus out pleasure after a certain period of time. So what do? You need to do different things to keep rekindling this happiness. So in our stupidity, what do? We probably try out different tastes. We try out different ways of finding the same pleasure. We modify the ways in which we have been drawing pleasure and try out different things. But eventually, all of this, if not in the immediate future, if not within this life, it will start plateauing out, and you will find that you don't find the same happiness in the same things that you've been doing. And that's the beautiful way by which nature pushes us, right? And this pushing will happen only if the second process of the brain starts kicking out. That's when the second aspect of the brain comes. I said one of the functions of the brain is self-preservation. The other is what we call self-extension, or self-actualization is also one way of looking at it, where the brain is constantly trying to understand what is this self, what is this idea of the self, right? So in a way, you can only have a limited amount of joy by giving pleasure to your own body. At some time, the next form of pleasure is when you're able to help somebody else, when you're able to use your body for the benefit of not just for yourself, but for at least one person, if not more, other than yourself, right? And they say that this becomes a very important aspect, especially in the human brain. That's why I said we have more emotional needs than just physical needs. And that is one of the reasons why Swami tells that beautiful Sanskrit shloka. He says, paropakarartham idam shariram. If this body has to be used to draw out enough happiness for ourselves, at some point, this body needs to be used for more people than oneself, right? That's what happens. And that is why, you know, being in a family, being in a marriage, being in good friendships, being helpful in your work environment, all of these helps, right? But again, this is an extension of yourself. When I say myself, My family is included in that. My colleagues are included in that. My friends are included in that. So at some point, you need to again push yourself further where you have to start drawing happiness from doing something for people who are probably complete strangers, who will never be able to give back to you. That is why seva becomes a very important aspect of being motivated, being healthy mentally. We don't realize that. That's why Swami says, Paropakaratam idam shariram. This body is meant to be of use to others. That is the way you're going to remain positive. That is the way your brain is going to push you towards where it can find more happiness and more long-lasting happiness. And of course, there are many, many processes and studies in this whole process, how they say that this kind of purpose, this kind of having a larger than yourself life, gives you happiness which is much, much more long-lasting than the happiness that can be got by, feeding your senses. That's a different study altogether, but at some point, that's why when I said, after she goes through medication, give her a change of environment, that could be very, very important. You know, if you can make her come and live with you in Canada, that would be beautiful. If you can make her live somewhere else for a short period of time, some kind of a change in environment, and then do all of this, make her do something physical like gardening or going out and helping some underprivileged school or whatever it is, and some form of seva, because this will take, putting it in normal words, it takes your mind off yourself, but actually chemically something happens in the brain when we do all this, and it helps us, it makes us positive. That's why as Sai devotees, we are so much in advantage. I always feel this way, that being Swami's devotees, having the advantage of turning to Swami whenever we are in trouble, having the advantage of this belief that Swami does care for me and Swami will take care of me, this is such an advantage. We actually don't really need any therapist, don't need any medical help in terms of mental health. But sometimes, for some of us, in the case that you explained, sometimes it happens that we slip into this case where it's a medical situation. That's when you need some kind of intervention from outside. Because even that, Swami's grace can overcome any kind of hurdle. There's nothing like, it has become a medical depression, so I cannot handle it. Swami is never going to say that. But if we look at it as what is our duty towards this person who is going through this, then probably we'll need to see all of this. And that's why I said, what keeps us motivated? This is what keeps us motivated. As we go through life, slowly and surely, we need to come out of our selfish bubble and we need to ask ourselves, am I using my time in a manner in which it is more useful than it is to me? Is it useful to at least one more person? Is it useful to my family? Is it useful to somebody who is a complete stranger to me? That is when true satisfaction to you have true satisfaction chemically in the brain. That's what happens. And that's how it has been programmed in us biologically, physically and spiritually, that we move from what Swami would say, I to we and we to he. Because eventually, the highest form of satisfaction, they say, comes from when we try to figure out the purpose. Right? I spoke about the prefrontal cortex being the most advanced part of any brain and which is there in the human nature. This is where all our questions of morality, of justice, of trying to find out, figure out what is life all about. All of those thoughts arise in what we call this prefrontal cortex. So at some time, the complete happiness or complete satisfaction will come only when we start addressing these things. And Swami would say, you try to find out about everybody around you. You keep asking, who are you? Who are you? What is this? What is that? But at some time, the truest form of happiness will come only when you turn inward and start asking, who am I? Right? Because this is how the brain itself is programmed. And the brain is nothing but a representation of the human mind. So that's the answer I wanted to give. So quickly summarizing, the first thing that you need to do is try to get some kind of medical help for her, because that is where it is going to start. But after that is when your real, what you can do for your sister will start. Try to help her come out of it by doing these things. You can give her a change of environment to start with. Then make her do something which will exert her physically, right? I don't need to talk about having, I mean, giving her good food and good sleep and all of that. I'm sure she'll be taking care of that and giving your family. But something else then you can do is get her involved in something which is going to be of some service to somebody else, somebody who cannot return that favor in any time in the near future, where she can do something which she feels that my time is useful to somebody. Once all of this comes, once she comes back to a pretty normal state of mental health, after that, I think you can sort out all the other specific problems she must have gone through. What you said about she doesn't like rules, she doesn't like the double standards in life. All of that can be sorted out after that. After that, I'm sure probably she will even figure it out herself. Swami is going to take care of that. But this is probably what you need to do. Thank you very much, brother, for asking me that question. Once again, whatever I've said is absolutely an amateur's version of what really the experts can have you say. But I just hope I've given you an idea and I've given you a direction as to what you can do. Of course, our prayers are with you. And I'm sure for all the service that your parents have offered Swami and offered Swami's devotees, Swami is definitely going to take care. The very fact that probably she's gone through the extended period within the bubble of the family and the care that all of you have given is probably a grace on her. Swami is making her go through something which she has to, but she's going through that under the very protective gaze of Swami. I think that's what is happening to her. So thank you very much for asking me this question. If there's anything more that you want me to clarify, you can always write to me and I'd be happy to do that. Well, that, dear listeners, is the answer for today. I thought I'll wrap up now, but I just remembered that last week when I was answering the question, I did mention that there's a beautiful Chinnakatha which Swami says about our hollow pride of being Indian, and I didn't have the time to narrate that. A lot of people wrote to me saying that, you know, you didn't tell the Chinnakatha. We would love to hear the Chinnakatha. Of course, I thought since I have a couple of minutes, I'll narrate that beautiful story which Swami would narrate. This is a story probably we should hear from Swami. I couldn't find a recording of that, but I've heard Swami saying this in Thrai Brindavan in such a beautiful animated way. This is a story which Swami would say. Swami was talking about Max Müller, who was a German philosopher, and he was distinct for his love for India. Swami would say that he was very, very fond of Indian culture. He was very fond of Vedas and Vedanta, and he was probably more Indian than most of us Indians. That's what Swami would say. So Swami was telling, Max Müller was once translating the Bhagavad Gita into German. Even now, the copy of Bhagavad Gita in Germany translated by Max Müller is very, very popular. So this happened when he was translating this copy of the Bhagavad Gita. And he was stuck at one particular verse. He was translating this shloka and he didn't know what is the best interpretation of that verse. And he was praying to God and saying, I'm not able to get this. Hope I'll get some clarity. And just then his assistant walks into the room and the assistant tells Max Müller that there's a person who's here to see you and this is his visiting card. And he hands out this visiting card and Max Müller looks at it and what does he find there? The name of this person who's come to visit him is Chaturvedi Amareshwara Shastri. Right? He's an Indian. He's an ICS officer, that Indian Civil Service, what we call Indian Administrative Service now, was Indian Civil Service pre-independence. So here was an ICS officer whose name was Chaturvedi Amareshwara Shastri, which literally translates into scholar of all the four Vedas, right? That's the meaning of the name. And Max Müller, who was very well-versed in Sanskrit, he read this name and he knew what it meant. And he was so thrilled. He said, an Indian person has come. And what is his name? The name suggests that he is the master of all the four Vedas. And how fortunate I am to be hosting such a person. And at such an appropriate time when I'm struggling to translate this Sanskrit verse. So he says that, you know, please make him sit down and make him comfortable. Tell him I'm coming right away, right? So immediately Max Muller rushes to him, and when he goes there, what does he see? He sees this man, who's of course indeed an Indian man, dressed in a three-piece suit, probably holding a pipe in his hand or whatever it is. Swami described he was just an English man and probably an Indian body, right? Because, of course, he was an ICS-trained person. Right? He was sitting there, and Max Muller goes to him with all reverence, and he says, Mr. Chaturvedi Amareshwara Shastri, what a pleasure it is to meet you. In fact, I was translating the Gita, and I was just hoping that you would come and explain this particular verse. And this man, who's Chaturvedi Amareshwara Shastri, you know, he says, do you still believe in this Bhagavad Gita, Veda and Vedanta and all? Oh, it's all just a waste of time. This is what this ICS officer says. And Max Muller says, how unfortunate you are. How really unfortunate you are to be born in a land like Bharat. It is a boon, it is a blessing to be born in this land. You were born, you were given that blessing. And you've been given such a beautiful name. You've been named the master of the four Vedas, Chaturvedi Amareshwara Shastri. Your parents have given you such a beautiful name. And after all these blessings, you don't know the value of being an Indian and the value of the spiritual heritage of your country. He says, how unfortunate it is. And Swami would narrate this story and say that that is the case with all of you who are very proud to be Indian, who is very proud of the Indian heritage, who is very proud of the scriptures and the past, but you don't allow that pride to dictate your life. You don't allow that pride to express itself in life. Really, that's probably perfect for all of us. I can tell that about me. And thanks to Swami, at least we have a little bit of interest in Indian spiritual heritage. But if not for that, this is the story I wanted to narrate yesterday, because, you know, this is how we literally sometimes cheat ourselves. We are proud to be Indian, but we don't do anything which really makes us Indian. Probably all that we can do is we pray to Swami that, Swami, give us sadbuddhi, give us sanmati, because that's the only way we can change ourselves and transform ourselves. But Swami in jest, Swami in anger, Swami in counsel, all the time was encouraging us to do the right things. How much more grateful can we be to Swami? How much more we can, I mean, is it ever enough if we thank Swami for all the love that He's been showering on us? Well, with that, dear listeners, I'll conclude this program. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for that brother who sent me that question. If you have a question that you would like me to answer on this show, please send it to me at prem@radiosai.org. That's P-R-E-M at radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. So the mails that you send to me will be read only by me. And like today's questioner, if you wish to be anonymous, do let me know. But let your questions be on practical spirituality and how to apply Swami's message, such beautiful, profound message that He has given us in our day-to-day life. I would be happy to answer that with Swami's grace. Of course, in a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Raghu for the next segment of the day with the Ashtotram. At 12:30, I'll be here with Arvind and, of course, another guest for the afternoon satsang. Do join me again for that. As always, I'm going to leave you with a song, which is, of course, one of my favorite songs. I really cannot get tired of listening to this, and I'm sure you all will enjoy the song as well. Thank you very much for being with me. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I'll meet you all again 11 a.m. next week on Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Saishwarani padamula sannidhine cherinanu Saishwarani padamula sannidhine cherinanu Sadananda vanidilo sanadola loginanu Saishwarani padamula sannidhine cherinanu Sadananda vanidilo sanadola loginanu Saishwarani padamula sannidhine cherinanu Hare Rama Hare Krishna Hare Sai Hare Hare Bhaje Sai Shanti Dai Satya Sai Hare 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 Rama Hare Krishna Hare Sai Hare Hare हरे भजे साई शांतिदाई सत्य साई हरे हरे साई ईश्वर नी पद मूल सन्निधि में चेरिना मन सुलोन भक्ति सुधा मधुरी मलि निंपिनानु कनुल लोन कांति प्रभ कवित ज्योति निलिपिनानु मन सुलोन भक्ति सुधा मधुरी मलि निंपिनानु कनुल लोन कांति प्रभ कवित ज्योति निलिपिनानु आराधन पूर्वक मुग अनवरत मुकोलिचिनानु आराधन पूर्वक मुग अनवरत मुकोलिचिनानु तनिवार गदरिचि करिंचे द स्वामी नेडु आराधन पूर्वक मुग अनवरत मुकोलिचिनानु तनिवार गदरिचि తరించె స్వామి నేడు సాయీశ్వర నీ పదముల సన్నిధిని చేరినా హృదయ పదములో నిరతము పదయుగమును నిలిపినాను భావవీధిలో సతతము సేవ చేయ తలచినాను ఆవేదన పొంగగ నను ఆవేదన పొంగగ నను ఆదు కొనగ వేడినాను పరమాభూత మహిమాన్విత కరుణ కోరినాను నేను సాయీశ్వర నీ పదముల సన్నిధిని చేరినాను త్రేతాయుగమందులయు సీతాపతి నీవు కదా ద్వాపరములో అవతరించిన సాయి విగ్రహ ఈ కలి కాలమున అవతరించిన సాయి విగ్రహ ప్రతివాస పరమ పురుష పరమాత్ముడ నీవే కదా ఈ కలి కాలమున అవతరించిన సాయి విగ్రహ ప్రతివాస పరమ పురుష పరమాత్ముడ నీవే కదా సాయీశ్వర నీ పదముల సన్నిధిని చేరినా ఆశ్రిత జన కోటి కల్ల అభయము సగుదాత నీవు నామ కీర్తనమున మురియు నారాయణ మూర్తి నీవు ఆశ్రిత జన కోటి కల్ల అభయము సగుదాత నీవు నామ కీర్తనమున మురియు నారాయణ మూర్తి నీవు లీలా మానుష దేహుడు బోళా శంకరుడ నీవు లీలా మానుష దేహుడు బోళా శంకరుడ నీవు త్రిలోకాత్మరూపుడవు దీన బాంధవుడవు నీవు లీలా మానుష దేహుడు బోళా శంకరుడు నీవు త్రిమూర్తాత్మరూపుడవు దీన బాంధవుడవు నీవు సాయీశ్వర నీ పదముల సన్నిధిని చేరినాను సదానంద వాణిదిలో సదాడోలలు మూడినాను సాయీశ్వర నీ పదముల సన్నిధిని చేరినాను హరే రామ హరే కృష్ణ హరే సాయి హరే 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 సాయి శాంతిదాయి సత్య సాయి హరే 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 రామ హరే కృష్ణ హరే సాయి హరే హరే భజే సాయి శాంతిదాయి సత్య సాయి హరే హరే భజే సాయి శాంతిదాయి సత్య సాయి హరే హరే భజే